What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Another beheading over the weekend by the self-declared Islamic State, or ISIS, this time of a British aid worker. And today in Paris, leaders from 30-plus countries and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry working on an international coalition to confront ISIS. Degrade and destroy it, says President Obama, without American combat troops. Coalition partners from the region will be crucial to that succeeding. Are they really on board? This hour On Point, putting together a Middle East coalition to fight ISIS. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see enough ready, willing, and able partners in the region to make this work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The President of the United States very clear last night in his White House speech to the nation that this would take, and he has, a coalition.
With a new Iraqi government in place and following consultations with allies abroad and Congress at home, I can announce that America will lead a broad coalition to roll back this terrorist threat.
John Kerry, Secretary of State, all over the region and beyond in recent days. Here he was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, last Thursday, the next day, talking to the BBC about what he called 10 Arab countries ready, have, he said, joined the U.S. in the fight against ISIS.
What they have done is sign up to the coalition, agree that ISIL has to be destroyed, accept the full parameters of President Obama's strategy. And now it will be worked out with the military experts and the intelligence experts exactly which country is doing what within the framework of that strategy.
And here's a little sound of that readiness. The foreign minister of Bahrain, Khalid Al-Khalifa, also in Jeddah for a meeting with Secretary of State John Kerry, talking about Bahrain's readiness.
We're always partners and allies and friends.
Thank you.
To keep this area of the world and the rest of the world peaceful, calm, and progressive moving forward. We try our best.
We'll try our best. Will that be enough? Good enough. Joining me today from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, one of a dozen journalists who met with President Obama last week before the president's big speech on ISIS. His new best-selling novel is The Director. David Ignatius, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
From London, Rula Khalaf joins us, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. Rula, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi. And from Amman, Jordan, Michelle Dunn is here, senior associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's a former Middle East specialist at the State Department from 86 to 03. Michelle Dunn in Amman, Jordan, thank you for being there.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Rula, let me come first to you. What's your feeling in Paris and Jeddah as you've seen countries in the region step up and commit or say whatever they have to say about this coalition in the week nearly soon since the president's speech? Do you see a firm Middle Eastern coalition coming together that would support the strategy laid out by President Obama?
Well, Tom, I'd say that in principle and in political terms, yes, everyone's on board to try to roll back ISIS, as the president says. But what's important here is to see what will happen in practice. And I think that there are a lot of various dynamics at play in the region today that will not make this as easy as it sounds. No two Arab countries get on with each other to begin with. So I think that's a challenge in itself. The way forward can't also be only military. And I think that different countries see political solutions for Iraq and for Syria differently. Let's just take, one example. A lot of these countries that the Secretary of State is talking about are Sunni countries in the Middle East. They don't even agree on what constitutes terrorism and what constitutes radical Islam. There's a big problem between them over, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood and the extent to which you should fight the Muslim Brotherhood as you're fighting ISIS. How much will they try to draw that into this campaign on ISIS, we'll have to see.
We'll look at conflicting agendas here and tensions. Michelle Dunn in Amman, Jordan. What's the minimum required to make the United States, the U.S. strategy work out here? What's the minimum they need from whom for this to succeed?
Well, Tom, I do think it is important to recognize that the United States is going to need different things from different partners, right? We can look at all the various Arab countries, Turkey, I mean, just even not to get into the European allies, but even the allies in the Middle East region, they have different things to offer. And I think as Rula was sort of indicating, there are a number of things that the United States would like some of the parties to stop doing, and that's much less out in the open. Some of them, like Turkey, have been allowing extremists to go over the border into Syria to fight the Syrian regime. Some of the countries in the region have been, you know, not so careful about stopping either their citizens or funds going to ISIS and so forth. So there are a lot of things like that. And as Rula was hinting at, the United States needs these countries to stop struggling against each other, because not only has there been some sort of a Sunni-Shia power struggle in the region, there's also been one among the main Sunni countries with, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the Emirates lining up on one side and Qatar and Turkey on the other. We need all of these to play together nicely, at least for the time being, in order to unify against the threat of ISIS.
That sounds like a pretty tall order. I mean, you're talking about struggles of centuries there, but we'll look at those tensions from a number of angles. David Ignatius, let me put the core basic question to you here. Yes, there's all kinds of support. Some countries could stop doing things that would be helpful here, but the heart of the president's plan is U.S. air power and somebody else's boots on the ground going after ISIS. That has to be a coalition partner of some kind. Who's boots on the ground in Iraq, in Syria, David?
Well, I think that's the shakiest part of the strategy. Air power can do a lot to degrade ISIS, as using the president's word, but it has limits, especially when ISIS is dug into urban areas in Iraq and Syria. Mosul's a big city. Somebody's going to go house to house and root out fighters there. It's hard for me to imagine Iraqi special forces, let alone a Sunni militia that the U.S. would create, being in any kind of training shape to do that sort of counterterrorism work for a long time, if ever. So I think there's an implicit sort of necessary additional part of this strategy, which is that U.S. special forces, perhaps joined by those from France, Britain, other countries, certainly Jordan, UAE, are going to have to be embedded with these partner forces on the ground. Otherwise, I just don't see it working. It's going to take 6 months to a year to train up Syrian opposition forces in the numbers sufficient to advance on Raqqa, which is the key safe haven that ISIS has in Syria. So I think that's the part where I'd most like to hear more detail.
Rula, what about this key piece? Who's actually going to get it done on the ground? The president's been very explicit in saying no combat forces here. David said they're going to have to be embedded. I mean, we look back at Fallujah, the battle there. That took more than just a few special forces embedded. That was full-on American military power, and it was not easy.
Well, I think that what's important to understand here is that this is not a traditional war. This is a campaign that's going to take, I'd say, years rather than 1 year. And I think that you have to take Iraq back to what you had in the period of around 2006, when the tribes and other Sunni groups turned against Al-Qaeda. You want to return to a situation where the Sunni groups themselves are getting rid of this problem. And I think, as David says, this will take time. This will also take some kind of assistance from special forces on the ground. And I think that may be that you can do more easily than what you will need in Syria, because in Syria, you have to build up a force from scratch, essentially. For the past year or so, the Saudis have been training a force in Jordan, a Syrian rebel force in Jordan. But from what I understand, that effort has not gone very far. Now, if the Americans are more involved in it, then maybe it can be more effective. But we are talking about a longer-term solution here.
Michelle Dunn, I just still have trouble seeing how this practically works. Who's going to root ISIS out of Mosul? Is it going to be Sunni tribes who materialize from northern Iraq, from the deserts and villages?
Tom, you know, I mean, counterinsurgency 101 is that you have to get the cooperation of the public, of the population of the area against the insurgents or the terrorists, right? Or else it isn't going to work, you know, and it's just going to go on for a very, very long time. So that's why, you know, President Obama started, and I think rightly so, with a political strategy toward Iraq. There had been this first step of basically, you know, forming a new Iraqi government without Prime Minister Maliki, and an attempt at least to signal a more inclusive approach that's going to bring Sunnis back in and help them feel less excluded. There's a lot more that has to be done inside of Iraq in order to for the Iraqi government forces. And there will also be the Kurdish Peshmerga forces involved in certain locations. And they have to get the cooperation of the population against the insurgents. So, yes, there will be training. There will be help by special forces, I think, from various countries. And there will be an air campaign to support that. Whether all of this is going to be enough at the end of the day, I think David is quite right to ask. To say that the plan on the ground is the weakest part.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are this hour doing a reality check on the anti-ISIS coalition, looking at who's really ready to do what and whether it all adds up in the president's strategy to take on the self-declared Islamic State. David Ignatius of The Washington Post joins us from Washington. Rula Khalaf with The Financial Times from London. Michelle Dunn with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace on the Middle East program there joins us from Amman, Jordan. President Obama said he needed to see a new government, a more tolerant government across Sunni-Shia lines in Baghdad. He got it. Here's the new Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, a meeting with Secretary of State John Kerry in Baghdad last week, talking about his country's role in the fight, but they need more, he said.
Of course, our role is to defend our country, but the international community is responsible to protect Iraq and protect Iraqis and the whole region.
We'll defend our country, but the international community is responsible to protect Iraq, the new prime minister saying there. In Egypt, the foreign minister Sameh Shoukry, in a meeting with John Kerry in Cairo on Saturday, said Egypt's committed, broadly here interpreted by Euronews.
I support the international efforts to fight terrorism and support the necessary measures to put an end to this phenomenon, whether in Iraq, Libya, or any part of the Arab world or Africa.
Support, but kind of broad. And from Iran today, a no thanks to joining the coalition and tough words about the U.S. leadership there. Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei was dismissive of the coalition. Now here, this is from Iran's English language television network, Press TV.
Ayatollah Khamenei also described as, quote, absurd, the international conference underway in France aimed at countering the rising threat of ISIL. He noted that there is ample evidence regarding U.S. officials' double standards on whether or not to invite Iran to the conference. The leader emphasized that it was, in fact, the Iraqi army and nation who dealt severe blows to ISIL.
And the effort underway in Paris to put together a coalition, absurd, says the Iranian leader, with a lot of influence right next door. Let's go down a kind of checklist here at how the different major regional partners look at this. David Ignatius, could we start with, let's start with Saudi Arabia. They've got, looks to me like conflicted interests right here. How do you see the Saudis looking at the U.S. call for coalition? What are they prepared to do? How far will they go?
Well, in terms of their rhetorical commitment, they've gone further than they did in the past. They are opening to the Shia-led government of Iraq, something that they refused to do when Maliki was the prime minister. I think when you look at Saudi Arabia, you can see where the seams of this policy come together somewhat uneasily. on the one hand, the idea of the strategy is to reassure Sunnis in Iraq and the Sunni world generally that their interests will be taken into account, that they won't be steamrolled by a Shia government in Baghdad or by Iran's proxies anywhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that outreach to the Sunnis, and the president's been careful to keep stressing that. On the other hand, the other seam of the strategy is to reconcile Sunnis and Shias, to bring a new Shia prime minister in who's ready to cooperate more with Sunnis, and in effect, to fight in parallel with Iran and Iran's special operations forces, which are in Iraq big time, fighting the same adversary. So can you do both? Can you reassure Sunnis and also fight in parallel with Iran? And I think that's the trick. I think it's the right thing to try, but it strikes me as the most delicate piece of this.
Rula, look at that piece. Ultimately, this is a long-term tension and conflict between these two. Saudi's been very worried about Iran. The whole tension in the Middle East has been described as proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Can you get them in this Obama strategy to fight in parallel, as David puts it, Rula?
Indeed, I think that is one of the major problems that faces the fight against ISIS, is that it comes at a time when Iran and Saudi Arabia, the two major powers in the region, one Sunni, one Shia, are at loggerheads and are fighting at the same time a proxy war. It is very crucial that they are brought a bit closer together. I say a bit because it'll be impossible to get, you know, consensus on all fronts. But I think that one of the challenges for the Obama administration is to try to put the two at least, or try to build some kind of an understanding between the two, at least when it comes to Iraq. Because at the end of the day, it is in both Saudi and Iranian interest for Iraq to be stabilized and, importantly, to maintain its territorial integrity.
Michelle Dunn and Amman Jordan, there's so much suspicion here. Can you get the Saudis and Iranians to, in effect, work together, even if they won't say so publicly?
I don't know if they'll work together. The question is, you know, if they will do things separately. Now, I mean, you know, Iran has, in a way, worked in parallel with the United States and to a certain degree in parallel with Saudi Arabia against the Taliban and against Al-Qaeda in the past. Mm-hmm. So it's not the first time. What's different here, though, is, as David said, the degree of Iranian involvement inside Iraq. And that's going to be critical, what Iran does inside Iraq. Now, we saw one positive signal, which is that Iran backed off supporting former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, whose removal really was essential to forming a more inclusive Iraqi government. That if Iran hadn't done that, I don't think the Iraqi government and new prime minister we've seen now that everybody is supporting would be possible. So Iran made a gesture there. But there are a lot of other things. And in particular, there are Shiite militias inside of Iraq that are, I think, are very dangerous and want to fight ISIS, but in a very sectarian way. And Iran is supporting them. So will Iran be willing to take steps against ISIS that are not so sectarian? And that, you know, because what obviously what the United States is going for is a more holistic and more inclusive approach inside of Iraq, not using Shiites to fight ISIS.
That's going to be a tough turn, perhaps. What about Jordan? You're there, Michelle. What are they prepared to actually do? Will they send Jordanian troops into Syria to go after ISIS?
I don't think that's envisioned at all at the present time. But Jordan has always cooperated a great deal with the United States in training. That's already been mentioned in training of Syrians and others inside of Jordan and Jordanian special forces. I think Jordanian intelligence cooperation. All of that will be very essential.
Let's go to our listeners who are really focused on this after the president's big call. Columbia, South Carolina, Sheldon's calling. Hi, Sheldon. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm former Air Force Special Operations, former Air Force Police, now medically retired.
Okay.
I also will say merhaba to you because that's how you say it in Turkish. And the reason why I say that is Turkey You know, I've been in Turkey since 1965. You know, I was born in 61, but my dad was over there. And I just believe, you know, down in my heart of hearts that Turkey's going to support us and all that. Now, Kuwait, you know, I was stationed over in Kuwait, and that was 3 months before we were attacked on September 11th. And Egypt, I believe, Britain, Germany, France, Switzerland, excuse me. But what I wanted to say was,
Hang in there, Sheldon. What do you think? The bottom line on Obama's plan, do you think it will work?
Yes, it will. He can't reveal all of it because it's national security, so I'm kind of hoarse and everything. But
he can't reveal all of it. Do you think he's holding special operations forces up his sleeve?
Yes,
he's actually going to send them in?
You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. He can't reveal it because he's got a plan. Even if we don't know it, if we can't see it, it's just like you said. He's got a plan. He's gonna figure this out.
Sheldon, let us pick it up right there and get a little bit of water. David Ignatius, the president, says no combat forces. Sheldon doesn't believe it. He's Special Operations Air Force. He says they'll be in there. What about it?
Well, I think Sheldon's right. And I think it's likely that this is speculation, obviously. But I would guess that there will be a component of this program that will be run under Title 50, which is the part of the U.S. code that allows the CIA to conduct covert operations that are deniable, in which U.S. Special Operations Forces cut to the CIA for this role will be operating certainly in Iraq, maybe even in Syria. And I think the idea is that some U.S. forces are going to be needed to stiffen the main boots on the ground, which will be Iraqi Sunni and tribal forces and the new Syrian moderate opposition forces that we're going to try to train in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. But my guess would be you'll have some Americans there, but in a different role, not in an open role.
That could end up being controversial, given the very strong promises the president has made here. Rula, what about Turkey? Our caller mentions Turkey, but Turkey, as I understand, has said no troops and no American use of their big airbase at Incirlik.
I think Turkey is in a very tricky position right now because they have more than 40 hostages that are being held by ISIS. And I think that they're making, you know, at least partly the decision-making is taking this into account and the potential for ISIS to execute those hostages. But I think more broadly, there is a certain reluctance. I see this a lot in the commentary that's coming out of the region in Turkey and in the Arab world. There's just the memories of Iraq and of any kind of American military intervention are still there. And I think that there is a general reluctance to get too involved in American-led military operations, however many partners the U.S. has.
Michelle, what do you see coming from Turkey ultimately? They're right there on that critical border with Syria. A lot of ISIS fighters have come across that border to support the Islamic State. What do you see coming there?
Well, there's no substitute for geography, is there? So, you know, Turkey's location there just to the north of Syria and is going to be, there's going to be a lot of things, as I said, that we need Turkey not to do or to stop doing, mostly letting people across. And I think there will be that kind of cooperation. But, you know, they've also declined to participate in a number of American operations in the past in terms of letting us use their bases and so forth. This isn't the first time this has happened. And they're also somewhat bitter. You know, the statements we see coming out now are rather bitter. Like, where were you when we asked for your help on Syria several years ago? And why didn't you do anything while 200,000 people died in Syria? So, they're also on one side of this regional divide or divide among Sunnis from Saudi Arabia. And so Turkey's not all that eager right now, but I think there will be some forms of quieter cooperation.
It sounds soft. It sounds soft. Bruce in Essex, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. When I called your screen there a half hour ago, I pointed out that there are no plans, and reminded him that when George Bush was asked back in 2002 what the plan was in Iraq, he responded that the plan is to win, which showed that George Bush was completely clueless of the difference between goals, strategies, and plans to execute the strategies. Now, as I listen, and I actually had just called back your screen to say I had given up, and then he decided to put me on the air, because when I hear endlessly about counterinsurgency 101 and hearts and minds and the difference between Sunnis and Shiites, first of all, the problem was caused by George Bush in the entire Mideast. The only opportunity was to eliminate an evil dictator. And instead of conducting a war of liberation, he conducted a war of conquest. And at the end of the war, even though back in World War II, we had learned in the occupation of Germany that denazification was a serious mistake, they went right ahead and repeated the same thing, swapped the dominant religious factions, and everything that's talked about, when they talk about now about a goal, there is no goal stated. It's just a vague desires.
Bruce, we've got it. Let me pick it up with my panel, and I appreciate your call. David Ignatius, I think it's not hard to look at this and feel a kind of mushiness here. Now, the president's response to that is sort of a temporal response. This will take a lot of time. No, we're not saying we're going to wrap it all up overnight. But there's been a lot of time already, and you hear Bruce looking at the net effect of American engagement already, which you could describe as what we're in the middle of now, David.
Well, I think you're right, and Bruce is right that there is some mushiness in this strategy. I think your listeners should understand that this is not as ambitious as it might seem. I mean, the phrase degrade and ultimately destroy, I'd put the emphasis on degrade for now. Mm-hmm. There is a longer-term aspect of the strategy that's going to involve, you know, many, many months of training people. In the short run, I think there's a fear that ISIS had just grown so fast. It was so potent and so toxic that Jordan was at risk, that beyond Jordan, if ISIS wasn't stopped soon, even Saudi Arabia might be at risk. So you needed to step up and bring U.S. air assets in. You know, people have used the analogy radiation to shrink a tumor, and then eventually you take the tumor out. But first you want to stop it and shrink it, and I think that's maybe the way that people should think about this.
What does degrade mean? Does it mean that ISIS would cease to control terrain, or the terrain it controls would simply gradually shrink?
It certainly their actions should be constrained. One government official noted to me a couple days ago that you don't see any more pictures of black flags flying from Humvees. I mean, they're using old stock footage now on their propaganda videos because it's become dangerous to be an ISIS fighter in Iraq, and soon will be dangerous to be one in Syria. So, you know, that's the degrade is just shifting that balance. They have intimidated everybody in the surrounding area. That's why they grew so fast, shifting the balance of power and intimidation a little bit. While these other things, you're sort of buying time, I think, with air power. Again, I don't mean that's one of the weaknesses of this strategy, is that it is buying time. A lot of the pieces aren't firmly in place yet.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are this hour doing a reality check on the anti-ISIS coalition, looking at who's really ready to do what and whether or not it all adds up. With Rula Khalaf of the Financial Times in London, Michelle Dunn, the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joining us today from Amman, Jordan, and David Ignatius of the Washington Post, joining us from Washington. Michelle, Rula, David, listeners responding here online. Hannah says, a reality check. This isn't President Bush 2's coalition of the willing. It's the retinue of the reluctant. Or another listener calls it the coalition of gnashed teeth. We'll see if it's more than that. Stephen wonders if ultimately we're going to have to carve Iraq and Syria up for the northern Sunnis. They want their stuff back. Rula, what about that? To make this work out, can it rely on a, you know, kumbaya Iraq where Shia and Sunni get along, the same in Syria?
Well, I mean, I think Iraq is very easy compared to Syria. I think at least in Iraq, what you have now is, you know, a Western-led coalition that's working with the government and with most of the political forces, whereas in Syria, you're actually practically working against the government because the stated American policy is that the regime of Bashar al-Assad should not be there. And so that makes it much more difficult. There are also very serious questions about who you can work with amongst a very diffused rebel force. Training, you know, you have to vet thousands of rebels and you have to make sure that even after you vet them and after you arm them, that they don't actually end up moving and shifting allegiances and going to other groups, which is what we've seen happen consistently over the past 2 years.
Michelle, talk with us about sequence here and what's likely to happen. Is the U.S. or with this coalition going to go after the Islamic State in Iraq first, go after Mosul and Tikrit and try and clear out them so the map doesn't look so big? Do they go after the headquarters in Syria first? Do they just push them back over the Syrian border and let Syria stew for a few more years as it has already for so many so bloodily?
Well, I'm not sure about the sequencing in Iraq versus Syria, but in terms of Syria itself, what we've heard so far is that initially what this would be about is probably very limited targeted strikes against specific ISIS leaders in Syria. I mean, the nature of the beast in Iraq versus Syria is quite different, right? As I think Rula said, Syria is more complicated in a way. It's also different from the point of view of even international law or U.S. law, because in Iraq, the government is asking for outside military intervention, whereas that's not the case in Syria, right? It would actually be considered an aggression against an act of war against the Syrian government here. So what I suspect is that we're going to see much more limited action in Syria. Now, President Obama said there will be action in Syria. There will be air attacks of some kind, but I think they will be very limited. And meanwhile, there will be perhaps, it has been promised, the stepped-up training and arming of the Syrian rebels. And as David indicated, it would take a long time for that to start to turn the tide on the ground inside of Syria.
David, are those so-called moderate rebels credible at all? I mean, there's already been effort on that front. U.S. put full-on effort, billions, into training up the Iraqi army. They scattered in front of ISIS forces. Is there any credibility to the Syrian moderates really stepping up as a forceful player in their own country?
Not so far. I mean, I talk often with them. I've traveled with them a bit, and in a sense, the problem with the Syrian moderate opposition is that it really is a bottom-up revolution. It's neighborhood by neighborhood, mosque by mosque. Okay. These are local leaders who resist coordination, resist command and control. I'm told there are well over 1,000 different brigades now operating more or less independently. The United States, since fairly early in 2013, has had a CIA covert training program based in Jordan that is, I'm told, now trained over 4,000 Syrian opposition fighters in a kind of a guerrilla army that, you know, moves and, you know, strikes targets, plays an increasing counterterrorism role. The real challenge is taking these neighborhood fighters, training them in a different kind of program, getting an army that would be well over 10,000 that could fill the space. The idea is as you push east in northern Syria towards Raqqa, that you make sure you have Syrian opposition forces that can fill that vacuum. That's one lesson of Iraq that people, I think, have learned. Don't knock over the pegs of something unless you're prepared to fill that space. So that's why it's going going to take a while. That's very much, I think, the way people at the Pentagon and the White House are thinking about this.
But, David, who is it that is pushing east in Syria? There's a dreaminess about all this that I find frustrating. I don't
entirely disagree, but I'll give you an example. There's a commander in Idlib who I've talked to on the phone, who's a charismatic young guy, again, bottom-up neighborhood guy, mm-hmm. Who's led a force that had some success in fighting ISIS in Idlib province, which is in the far west of Syria. I mean, yep. He really rooted the ISIS fighters out of his area. He's now moving toward Aleppo, and Aleppo, I think, is going to be the first big challenge for this strategy in Syria. It's crucial to clear the ISIS, the Islamist fighters from Aleppo, and then be able to begin moving east. Who'll do it? People like this commander from Idlib, who's been out, who's been, I think, in liaison regularly with the Americans and their partners, the Jordanians and others.
Michelle, can we just march a curtain of air-dropped, you know, bombs and missiles down and march it east across Syria and have these moderates follow up behind and boom, we're all done? That seems A, destructive to civilians, B, hard to picture.
I don't think the opposition forces are not in a place to do that now. That's why I think initially what the U.S. does inside of Syria is going to look a little bit more like what the United States has done in Yemen, for example. You know, targeted strikes against specific ISIS leaders, because everyone realizes this, that it's not going to work to just attack mm-hmm. ISIS in Iraq and leave the leadership in place and operating in Syria.
Let's go to Rhonda in Charleston, South Carolina. Rhonda, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I was recently, just last month, in the Emirates as well as Brunei and throughout Malaysia. I was really astounded at the interest and the consumption of Western goods throughout the Emirates and Brunei. My suggestion wouldn't be applicable to Syria necessarily, but I don't understand why the United States, Europe, isn't putting more pressure on these high consumption Western goods countries for some cooperation. I think if we restricted the Rolexes, the Chanel, the Mercedes, the Jaguars, we could really get their attention and perhaps encourage the UAE, in particular, whether Sunni or Shia, to take in refugees from Syria and try to help stabilize that population.
Rhonda, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Of course, you get the attention of European manufacturers, too. But, Rula, how about it? Oh, sort of cut off their Gucci bags, and they'll start sending fighter jets and troops.
A trade embargo, that's an interesting idea, except it wouldn't work for all sorts of reasons. I don't think that the U.S. in any case doesn't try to put pressure. I think what you've had in a lot of countries in the past few years is a sort of new attitude towards the U.S., whereby they don't just want to listen. They have their own demands. And when the U.S. doesn't respond, and there, I'm talking particularly about a lot of Arab countries having asked for American involvement in Syria and having been told by President Obama that that would not be forthcoming. That has created a lot of frustration. So has the U.S. and Europe. The talks with Iran, which is seen as the main regional rival. So I think that we're now in a situation where, countries like Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, actually, when they get asked for something, they ask for something in return.
David, you've written in particular about Saudi Arabia and the limits on its potential support here for the U.S., the conflicts within Saudi Arabia, even its own former chief of intelligence, Prince Bandar. People not quite sure where he stands on all this. Lay some of that out for us, David.
Well, if you step back, you have to be honest, I think, and say that the growth of ISIS comes out of an effort by the Saudis, government and private citizens, and other Gulf Arab countries to support a Sunni resistance to Bashar al-Assad in Syria, you know, as part of what they really saw as a regional proxy war. They were scared of Iran, wanting to clip Iran's wings, and so began supplying substantial money and other assistance to these groups. And as Rula said earlier, the problem is that they may have started out giving it to relatively moderate Islamist groups, some of them, but they didn't prove to be very good fighters. And so the people and the weapons and the money ended up gravitating toward the more extremist fighters, who were the toughest people on the street, and began to get the street cred. So now Saudi Arabia finds that this movement that it, you know, didn't think it was creating has become a monster, and it frightens Saudi Arabia. Prince Bandar, who was a quite erratic intelligence chief who upset many Americans and other Saudi partners, was removed last spring as head of Saudi intelligence. He was replaced before that as head of the Syria opposition support program. The new head of Saudi intelligence, a man named Khalid bin Bandar, is seen by the Americans as a much more professional person who's trying to create, really for the first time, a professional Saudi intelligence service. The U.S. also likes the Saudi Minister of the Interior, Mohammed bin Nayef, a lot, and trusts him. But I think there's a feeling that the kingdom itself is in the early stages of generational change. King Abdullah is popular, but he's old. He's 90 or 91 by some estimates. It's interesting that he's been talking often by phone to President Obama. But our key ally in this fight, it's argued, is in a somewhat fragile shape.
Are they, to the extent that there's sympathy, if that's what it is, for the Islamic State, is that anti-Iranian, anti-Shia sympathy, or is it pro-Salafi sympathy, David?
Well, I caution. I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for the Islamic State. There certainly is for the Salafist vision of Islam, the Mufti,
which includes
in Saudi
a caliphate,
Arabia.
And there is one. Boom.
Yes. You know, but the Mufti in Saudi Arabia, supported by the king, supported by all of the religious and other establishment, have been quite forthright in saying ISIS is our enemy. They held this meeting in Jeddah of all the key foreign ministers. It's interesting to me that Lebanon was invited. Lebanon is a government dominated by Hezbollah, dominated by people who are nominally Saudi Arabia's enemies. Iraq, Shia-dominated, close to Iran, was also invited. I'd be curious about the view of Rula and Michelle, who know this better than I. But I sense the Saudis wanting to reach out to a broader array of partners because they're scared.
Well, let's ask. Rula, do you see enough common interest here to put aside some of the very deep Sunni-Shia tension and work together on pushing back the Islamic State?
I think let me just make a point first. If it's very, very difficult to gauge Saudi public opinion, but one way to get a bit of a sense is by looking at Twitter feeds. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting to note that a lot of the popular, many of the popular sheikhs, and I'm not talking about the ones that are part of the establishment, have had an ambiguous discourse when it comes to ISIS. And I think that, you know, you can see a lot of kind of, you know, ambiguous, or we're not quite sure whether to support ISIS or not to support ISIS. And I think it's important that the establishment has now come out so strongly against it. But I think that there is a very live internal debate in Saudi Arabia about, you know, to what extent does our Salafi ideology actually lead people to this extreme. It, you know, are our teachings, what we teach at schools, what we say in mosques, is that contributing to this? And, you know, what do we do about it? It's a little bit of a similar situation than what we saw after 9/11, when Saudi Arabia went through several years of introspection and several years of soul searching as to, you know, with people a lot of the liberals asking, you know, are we contributing to this and what do we do about it?
Michelle, there in Amman, Jordan, it was said before the president's speech by many the Islamic State wanted to provoke the United States to come in here. Ultimately, that would give them a propaganda victory. It would be the Islamic world against the United States. Which way do you see this going so far? Who's winning the spin on this?
Yeah, I think there might be a lot to that. And then, I mean, we've seen now the execution of this British hostage, and one wonders, what's that about? Is that trying to overcome British reluctance and bring the British in militarily against ISIS as well? Now, I think that may very well be true. And in that case, ISIS would be banking on lack of follow-through, lack of resolve on the West part, that the West would take some very limited action that ISIS can then use to gather more recruits. They refer to this, of course, as a crusade, a Western crusade against Islam, and that the West will then give up and turn away before the job is completed. So there's a game of chicken going on.
Lots of rhetorical support, some material support, but lots of questions still over the coalition that's supposed to get this done. Fascinating to hear the three of you lay some of those out for us, and we're very grateful. Michelle Dunn with the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joining us today from Amman, Jordan. Thank you, Michelle. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Rula Khalaf at the Financial Times in London, Middle East editor there. It's always good to hear from you, Rula. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And David Ignatius out with his new best-selling novel, The Director, foreign affairs columnist at the Washington Post. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.